This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
This is Chris Evans with the Storage Unpacked podcast, and I'm here with Martin. How are you doing, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad. How are you, Chris?
Yeah, not bad, not bad. Ready for the second lockdown?
Yeah, we've got another couple of days, and then we can't go out again.
Yeah, we're locked down for yet again, but never mind. That's fine. We can still do things remotely like we're doing now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, absolutely. So this week we have a slightly interesting diversion for what we would normally talk about. Normally we talk about pure, just, you know, unadulterated storage. This time we're going to look at something a bit more structured. And we're going to have a conversation with Evan Weaver from Fauna. Now, I've said Fauna, and I'm listening to myself saying Fauna, and maybe that would sound better. So I'll say it again. Evan Weaver from Fauna. Evan, tell us what the company does. Give us a little bit of background about yourself, and then we'll dive into a conversation.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm Evan Weaver, CTO, co-founder of Fauna. Fauna is the data API for modern applications. What we've built is a global transactional serverless database that's delivered as an API so that developers don't have to worry about any operational overhead or decisions whatsoever.
That sounds like a great thing, Martin, not having to talk to DBAs.
That's not very nice. Some of my best friends are DBAs.
Oh, that is true. Yeah, sorry, I should say that. That's a bit harsh.
I think we've all been a DBA in the past. So yeah. The DBA's ultimate dream is to automate their entire job away, right? So that's basically what we're doing.
Absolutely. Okay, brilliant. So let's just start with a bit of background, you know, because from a cloud perspective, and we'll dive into your technology in more detail, but just looking at the market itself, you know, we've gone through a number of transitions from probably the days where Martin and I would actually have to talk to a DBA about things like RAID 5 and RAID 1 to very much databases on VMs and even databases as a service in the cloud. And it's been a sort of an evolution, hasn't it, really, of trying to abstract away the detail from the DBA and focus more on the data than the underlying technology.
Yeah, it absolutely has. You know, we've been through, you know, a number of generations, especially in cloud operations. And we think, you know, one of the things we're driving towards at Fauna is what's actually a return to a previous generation, which is client-server architecture. But, you know, things are different now because your client, you know, isn't a PC on the LAN in a single office building. People have rich clients in their browsers, in their laptops, in their phones, and they need to talk to backends, you know, over protocols that are web native and secure, as opposed to the protocols we would have used in the past. So we call this new generation of technology, which includes serverless and Edge and Jamstack and all this kind of stuff, client serverless.
Ah, okay, interesting. I mean, that is a pretty interesting distinction, Martin, to think of the idea of the fact that, you know, previous architectures we would have sat there with 3-tier, perhaps you might want to call it, but that very strict, rigid sort of database application front end. And then the user talking to that. But of course, it's very different now with mobile apps, with all sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to talk about different types of applications. And we know that the traditional databases will survive for some time. But when you've got mobile apps and your client is, it could be a mobile app, it could be on your PC, who knows, it could be your radiator or your boiler at some point in the future. So these things will change very different, will become very different.
Okay, so I mean, I guess, Evan, that's effectively what you're saying is that, you know, there is no need for us to have that rigid architecture anymore. In the end point, the end user, the end point of the actual database could be a device. It could be something that's creating log data. It could be all sorts of things. It doesn't necessarily have to be a human.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And that's part of the move to, you know, sort of these globally ubiquitous, you know, connected services and applications. Because I think too, if you think back, you know, in the 80s, the early 90s, you know, we had things like mainframes. You know, you use a thin client to talk to them. You write Microsoft Access apps on a PC. They talk to a SQL server sitting in a closet somewhere. You know, this was a productive development model. You could take advantage of the capabilities of the end user device. But then it turned out, you know, the connectivity of the web, being able to deliver a service or even just static content to people anywhere was so powerful that we basically threw all that away. So we went through two generations of the web, with web 1.0 with LAMP, and, you know, MySQL was the kind of the default, you know, server-side database there. the beginnings of the three-tier architecture, like Martin mentioned, you know, and then Web 2.0 with things like Postgres and Rails and J2EE and Hibernate and all these more agile object-oriented technologies. And that gave us, you know, almost as much dynamicism, richness, flexibility in our web applications as we had in our desktop PC applications, but not quite enough. But now we're back in a world where people have devices, you know, and people have networks, people have access, which is sufficient for these fully dynamic, rich application experiences. But what they don't have are backends that can support that, you know, ubiquitous mobile access. Because, you know, the devices, the clients, the applications, they move, they come off and off, you know, on and offline all the time. Like you mentioned, you know, you have connected devices, not just, you know, business applications that need to have this ubiquitous low latency access to a secure backend. And that's really what Fauna is all about, being the database layer for this new world of connected rich applications.
Okay, fantastic. So, I mean, one of the most obvious things here is that people don't even need to spend time building out a database infrastructure if they use your technology. You know, you could build your own app and then just say, well, as long as I've got a secure way of talking to that app, which we'll discuss exactly how you're managing that, now I don't even have to build any back-end infrastructure. I just have to build an API endpoint into my database in a secure way that allows me to write my data into that platform. So writing apps or doing anything like that is even more simple than it ever used to be.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, me and my co-founder, we got our start at Twitter. Before Twitter, I worked at CNET Network. And the team I worked with, they went on to found GitHub. I left for Twitter around the same time. And Twitter was one of the first, you know, soft, real-time, globally connected applications. Even Facebook at the time that Twitter started was going like school by school, very locally focused. There wasn't this kind of ubiquitous connectivity. There was no mobile experience at all. Nothing was real time. It was still essentially static content. You know, Fauna developed out of our experience building and scaling Twitter.com. Because when we went there, we were a small team. I was employee 15. And, you know, there were only like five other engineers. We weren't there to, you know, push the state of the art and distributed systems. We weren't there because we were like super passionate about scalable data. We were there because we wanted Twitter, the product, to stay alive. But we couldn't find anything off the shelf that would let a small team build and scale a service like that, you know, to global real-time scale. And when we left Twitter, you know, about 4 or 5 years later, we found that the state of the art and especially data backends hadn't really progressed that much. Like, we had cloud managed services now. You know, they took away kind of the physical administration. You didn't have to rack a database machine anymore. And then some of the operating system maintenance and that kind of thing started to get abstracted too. But at the end of the day, it's still all built around this metaphor of a physical provisioned server that lives in a single location. And you still have to think about vertical scalability limits, partitioning, sharding, you know, latency and consistency when you query it from other locations or query replicas, data redundancy and durability and recovery and all that kind of stuff. And it's just, you know, it gets in the way of just building the application. And that's the world we wanted to deliver with Fauna. Let end developers, front-end developers, product engineers, like you're talking about, just focus on what their app needs to do and kind of realize that utility computing dream where you can get, you know, compute, database, storage, just, you know, on demand forever.
Right. Okay. So let's dig down into some of the more deeper, interesting pieces of the architecture then, because you've highlighted a number of things there already, you know, that ability to make sure that this is potentially globally available, always on, reliable, always up, protected. And, you know, for those of us who've come from an infrastructure background, we would look at challenges, and I've made a big list of those, well, a small list of it. Things like latency and replication and data consistency and protection. You know, as soon as you scale out any sort of database past a certain size and you want to keep it consistent across multiple physical back-end machines, there's an issue of consistency, for example. So you must have had a significant number of challenges to overcome in order to build a platform that wherever you access it from in the world, wherever you are, always looks consistent to that end user.
We definitely did, and this pushed us in a direction that, you know, was contrary to the entire rest of the industry. Because there was quite a bit of research when we started this project and this company about, you know, scaling out strict serializability, transactionality, strong consistency, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, sort of we've been through three generations as an industry, you know, in this kind of scale out model. And I guess you could say generation zero is just the single server. You know, there's a giant mutex around the transaction commit. Maybe there's optimistic concurrency control to make it faster, but at the end of the day, you're serializing every transaction through a single physical CPU. You don't have too many problems when you're doing that. You have to f-sync at the right time. That's kind of it. You know, you can focus on the query language and the performance of the sort of the compute capabilities of that system. Well, the first sort of scale-out system that really worked, you know, that transcended that model was Google's Percolator. But all Percolator really does is scale that single server up to data center size. So instead of having a single CPU, you have a single server which acts as the coordinator and the clock for all transactions that other nodes have to talk to. And so that works, you know, when you have a really low latency local link, but that doesn't work at multi-region scale. Mm. And Google's...
Let me just point out one thing there, which I think is quite interesting. So you talk about a single clock. Now, Martin and I both came from a mainframe background many, many years ago. And one of the technologies they had on that platform was something called parallel sysplex, which you may or may not have heard of. And the idea of the sysplex was basically to be the timer for all of the other nodes that you could have connected to it. So if you had multiple mainframe environments connected to something, you had a physical hardware timer that made sure that any timestamp on any of those machines was absolutely consistent. And it's really fascinating to see that some of the technology we talk about now, especially, you know, some of that sort of technology like Percolator, still requires that some challenge or some way of getting over that timer consistency problem.
Yeah, Percolator is exactly that, just on commodity hardware instead of high availability, you know, mainframe hardware. So these same concepts from, like, you know, I don't know if System Z did, like, the lockstep CPUs that were always synchronized, right? And, like, Tandem Nonstop had similar technology, I think. These designs based on, you know, existing physical constraints were scaled up and extended, and that got us part of the way. The next step that, in particular, Google, again, did to push the industry forward is what Google Spanner does, where they have atomic clocks in each data center, and those have known latency variance between, you know, both what they think the time is and how long it takes the server to query the clock and get the time back. And that lets them do things like, you know, synchronize locking windows across transactions without cross-region coordination. And then if you want a strict read, you have to wait a few milliseconds. If you want a slightly staler read, you can query it any time. It tells you what timestamp it is and that kind of thing. But this system, you know, it's highly latency sensitive. It's relatively expensive to operate. Not all of us have access to atomic clocks in every computer we use. You know, it doesn't work across multi-cloud because the links are uncontrolled latency and that kind of thing. And at the same time, you know, in various circumstances, it still has to do multiple round trips to the replicas to, you know, make sure that the replication actually arrives, because it's essentially dropping locks, you know, into the places where the data is already stored. Well, what we were trying to do, you know, is deliver the lowest possible latency experience on the WAN that we possibly could. And that pushed us to pick up an algorithm called Calvin, which no one else in the industry had successfully commercialized until us.
Very quickly, Martin, just, you know, it's funny, isn't it, how this, the technology that we see occur over time is quite frequently a repetition of what we've already seen in the past. And it's quite good, actually, because for people like us who have been around a bit longer, it makes it relatively easy for us to understand it sometimes because we've seen some of it before.
Well, I think there's an argument. You can probably look at this, Chris, and say the problems have been the same across the generations. I mean, time has always been a problem. So everybody's going to come round and they're going to look at it and how you solve these problems. You may find that you solve, certainly the obvious ways of solving the problems actually have been done before. Not everybody's aware of the previous art and they think they've been really clever because but all they've done is they've re-implemented something which has been done before. So, I mean, computing's still a fairly young science or young craft, but we've solved a lot of the problems up in the past. I mean, time, latency. If you think where the initial real big burst of computing, certainly when it moved into business, was finance, timestamps, synchronizing clocks. incredibly important when you're dealing with finance, because if you can hack the clock, you can do all kinds of nasty things. So, yeah, but it doesn't surprise me. We keep seeing the same things coming up and again and again and again.
Evan, let's talk about Calvin then and explain what that is and how that is useful to you in your environment.
So what Calvin does, which is very novel, and obviously we've extended it and evolved it quite a bit at Fauna to make it real in an industrial setting. But what Calvin does is essentially invert this model. Instead of writing, you know, write effects into replica shards or partitions and then looking at the time to see when that transaction occurred, what Calvin does is instead bundle every transaction into an atomic set of updates that it then writes to a globally distributed, strongly consistent log, which for us is implemented in Raft. It could be implemented in Paxos or any of these other similar strong replication systems. And then the replicas, the replicant nodes, which are spread around the world, don't have to coordinate on anything else. What they do is they read the transaction order from the log. The log itself assigns a timestamp to each transaction, which roughly tracks the physical time, but doesn't have to. And the replicas apply these write effects in a deterministic order, which is where the name Calvin comes from, sort of the predeterminism of the religious concept there. So the replicas are applying these transactions in the same order at the same logical time without necessarily knowing what the effect of the transaction ultimately is going to be, whether it succeeded or failed. And then once any replica actually processes the transaction, it can report back to the client that originated it what the result is. So this inversion of determining the transaction order and the write effects and the timestamp is the key insight of Calvin. And the big thing that gives us in terms of a latency and performance profile is that transactional commits only require a majority round trip among the replicas. So we can have a global cluster of fauna regions with multiple nodes within them. All the regions can be heterogeneous. They can, they're not shards that all have to be updated, in the same way in every region, in every replica. They can be partitioned, unique, to the hardware that's available in that particular site, the logical databases that are assigned to that site. And we can guarantee in a global context that you still get a majority round trip, single phase latency on commit, which is essentially the best possible latency you can get if you want to have durability to a majority of the regions, in that commit cluster.
Right. So what do you give up for that then? Is there anything that you have to compromise on either in design or consistency or the types of data you can support, or is there a compromise in some way?
So what we give up is really the ability to at least easily implement long-lived interactive transactions, like the type of SQL session you would be accustomed to. Begin transaction, do a bunch of stuff, have the application think about it, write a few rows, think about it some more, and eventually commit it. That doesn't work very well in Calvin because we have to bundle the entire transaction into an atomic unit of update, like a pure function that runs across the state of the database at a particular point in time. That's not a real downside for us because Fauna doesn't, at least currently, Fauna doesn't implement an SQL API. It implements a relational document API, more similar to MongoDB.
Okay.
With foreign keys and constraints and transactions and all that good stuff.
But I would imagine that thinking about that possibly doesn't really matter too much, depending on the use case and the application that's talking to you, to your platform. Because if, for instance, you're a device connected across a WAN, or you're something like something that's logging data, or it's a mobile device, the chances are you're not going to run a long-lived transaction in any case, because that's not the model of the way the application would talk to the database itself. It's much more of a short, sharp, get the data, present it, wait, try again, and repeat, rather than it being a long-running transaction model in the first place.
Yeah, that's exactly true. The web and web APIs aren't designed around a long-lived transaction model at all. So, you're sending one-shot short requests that include the entire transaction state, and that's what that's what load balancers work with. That's what mobile clients and embedded clients and browsers work with. That's the entire connectivity chain that we're participating in. So it's not a serious downside by any means for us. And one of the best things about Calvin too is that the read latency you know, can be just as good as Spanner. You can get consistent reads from the local data center without doing any kind of global coordination whatsoever. So you can get sort of that single millisecond, you know, latency experience from anywhere and never have to think about, you know, talking to this or that region in order to ensure that you get, you know, the freshest data, that your transaction commits properly, or, you know, that, you know, if you take, you know, another system, for example, DynamoDB, which is strongly consistent updates on a per key basis within a single region. Well, that's really great if you only want to transact in that single region, but everything is eventually consistent when you replicate it out. So then you have to think about, you know, am I going to conflict? Oh, then the application has to divert this transaction back to the primary region. Oh, the primary region is across the ocean, so it's going to be a lot slower. You know, maybe I don't really want to do this at all. And then start to fall back to a more traditional three-tier architecture where the application lives adjacent to the database to avoid these kind of problems.
Now, I'd just like to point something out actually to you, and that's the effect that I've seen with Twitter in the early days when, being based in the UK, performance was okay, it was all right. You know, you didn't really know any different. And then I happened to be in San Francisco, well, in San Jose or Santa Clara one day, and suddenly noticed how quickly my queries and everything else I was doing, it was just like, oh my goodness, it is so much quicker. And that's when you suddenly think, yeah, okay, so maybe on a globally distributed system like Twitter, there is a significant difference depending on how that system's been set up. Now, I don't know whether it's still as bad as... I shouldn't use the term bad, should I? I don't know if it still exists to the same degree like that now, but it certainly was very noticeable coming over from the UK and being very close to where clearly I assume the servers were based.
Yeah, in the early days, you know, I mean, like Twitter grew up from a CMS, essentially. It was a traditional Rails app backed by a single MySQL server, not a cluster, literally one server. And, you know, we went through sort of the traditional scaling path that, like, you know, companies like LiveJournal, for example, and Facebook had paved before us a little bit. But we quickly found that, you know, these two factors, the real-time nature of the distribution, you know, waiting for some cache to expire to see your blog is totally fine, but to receive a tweet, you know, that people are also replying to in real time doesn't work. So we had to invert the caching model completely and materialize timelines in RAM basically throughout the entire data center. That plus the global distribution and the, you know, the chattiness of the traditional web architecture, both the clients making lots of AJAX calls or API calls back to a single data center and the application servers running Ruby and Scala in those data centers, you know, chatting transactionally to the databases, even including the databases that we sharded and scaled out with our custom services. You know, that meant it was very difficult for Twitter to evolve to a truly global distributed system that didn't have a single source of truth. And, you know, I won't speak to Twitter's current state because I haven't been there in quite some time, but kind of the, you know, the current state of the art for most of these consumer internet companies that are mature is that they end up just partitioning by geography. So there's like an entire copy of the app, including the database, for North America, for Europe, for, you know, basically on a continental basis. And that works pretty okay. Like in a consumer app in particular, people would tolerate, you know, 100 or 200 milliseconds latency. When you have IoT devices or you need transactional guarantees across regions because people can still, you know, talk to each other across regions, when you have to port people's accounts because they moved, then things get really hairy. And those are all those problems are problems we knew when we were at Twitter. They weren't fundamental. Like, there's nothing in computer science that says you can't have a global, ubiquitously available system. But just the industry state of the art has not progressed and to the point where it can deliver those tools in a way that they're consumable by a product developer.
But we're going to need that, and that's going to be something we're going to see time and time again going forward. So what use cases are you seeing customers deploy this for so far? I think it'd be good to understand some of the, you know, some of those different use cases you're seeing in place already.
Yeah, so we see... And we see a ton of consumer internet, we see a ton of SaaS, and, you know, both of those things make sense given our background and given Fauna's goals. You know, Fauna is usable from front-end technology like React.js and all the frameworks built on it, you know, hosting platforms like Vercel and Netlify for Jamstack. It's usable from, serverless compute like AWS Lambda and Cloudflare Workers and all the equivalents and the other hyperscale cloud providers. It's usable from traditional and containerized systems because basically anything that can call an API with an access key can call Fauna. And you don't have to worry about, you know, maintaining a connection pool. You don't have to worry about your security model. You know, you can get access to, you know, essentially, if not co-located, a near copy of your data because of Fauna's global distribution. And we soon have the ability coming online to let you choose which regions you want your data replicated to, both for compliance and latency purposes. And, you know, these kind of things mean that any product or application developer can successfully use Fauna, especially if you use JavaScript or Java, which are primary supported stacks, but there are drivers for, you know, Scala, Go, Python, all kinds of stuff. And, you know, for consumer internet, you know, the low latency, the real-time transactionality, the global distribution is really important, basically, to build things, you know, similar to Twitter. And for SaaS, you know, Fauna has some unique features that make SaaS really good as well, in particular, the internal multi-tenancy. Your Fauna database can have child databases basically to any level, so you can easily isolate your own customers without having to statically provision, you know, hardware or try to manage boundaries between them in a seamless way, the way you would have to do if you had like a tenancy column in a SQL database. And then we also have a temporality feature, which means you can go back in time in your data, you can checkpoint things, you can give people audit views very easily, things that make it very easy to develop, you know, a business critical product on top of a database. And partly, you know, they give you some comfort that, you know, people like to, you know, databases are a conservative industry, right? People like to be able to like kick it and poke it and feel like they're in control of it. And having these kind of capabilities helps us, you know, give transparency to the developer.
Yeah. So that's the question I was going to come to you with, Martin, because inevitably we'll have to ask this question as a storage podcast around the things we always ask every time, that whole idea of how's my data protected, how's my data secured, what happens if it breaks, all those sort of things. You know, what's your concern on that, Martin? And do you think this is something you would think that would be used in your sort of business?
Yeah, I can see it being used for some of the stuff in our business. I mean, there's not a problem with it. I think the biggest thing is actually thinking about this in a different way. We obviously talk about, if you look at most large enterprises, we have an existing application stack, and think about how they would move it to something like this. And obviously it means a rethink. And I think that's where we are in the industry, thinking about how serverless impacts us. In general, a lot of applications are going to need rethinking. Otherwise, we'll just carry on doing the same old stuff and we'll just look for a different relational database. So I'd be interested, so some of this is people are going to want things like a SQL interface into this. But inevitably, people were going to try and translate it in their minds to traditional RDMS. So how can you reassure people? How can you assist people in moving them away from their traditional RDMS systems, their Oracles, their MySQLs, their Access, their SQL Server? How do you enable existing database users to start pushing the state of the art towards you?
Yeah, so we don't really expect people to, you know, read the Fauna blog and rip out a database they've used for 20 years to port everything over, right? What we do see, you know, are new app starts, new products being built on a fully serverless stack, including Fauna. We see a lot of augmentation where you have a legacy, you know, you have a legacy infrastructure. And you just don't want to mess with it too much. You know, it's become brittle. It's become, you know, kind of a minefield because of the way it's grown over time. And it's easier for new product data to, you know, if you're writing, for example, a mobile or a web app, you know, integrate with Fauna for that new data from the front-end application or from a serverless compute tier and still talk to your existing back-end through APIs. And that's, you know, we see a lot of that across the industry. People are encapsulating all their legacy infrastructure behind APIs. Well, if you want to build something new, you're not going to spin up an entire legacy infrastructure stack to get another API. You want to just get an API straight up and interact with that directly. So we see a lot of transition in the industry. At the same time, you know, we do have a standardized GraphQL interface. GraphQL isn't as flexible as SQL, but it is, you know, it is a public standard. You know, there are alternative databases in the market and middleware you can get to integrate through GraphQL, and that gives people some peace of mind about switching costs and familiarity with the interface patterns and the programming patterns when they're using Fauna.
Okay, so if I wanted to try this out, or if anybody wanted to try this out, what's the consumption model? How can they go out and try it? What is it going to cost them to try it out? What's your charging model? How do we understand that side of it?
So everything's pay as you go. It is fully serverless, and there's a free forever trial plan, which is pretty generous as far as the industry goes. That basically lets you do all your development without having to pay for anything until you scale. So if you go to fauna.com, you can sign up. You can go through the tutorial on the web. You know, create some collections, insert some documents, use GraphQL, get a feel for the capabilities in the query interface, and then you can. You know, we have a lot of tutorials for different languages and different frameworks you can grab from that point forward to get going. But our goal is to make sure that, you know, an individual developer, a small team, whether they're independent or within a larger company, can really build a product end to end without having to incur, you know, operational overhead, without having to learn or relearn or suffer from, you know, sort of the burden of managing physical or virtualized infrastructure.
I think the takeaway for me from this is just, I think you've mentioned it a couple of times, Martin, it's that complete change of mindset of thinking that you just don't need to build what you've done before, that you need to step back and just say, do you know what, this is going to deliver me something which is operating in a totally different way, in a totally different level. And if I am developing something that is, for example, a web app or, you know, mobile app or something like that, why bother having any infrastructure in my data center anymore? The key bit, I guess, if you're going to do something that's going to become commercial, is knowing that if something happens with your data or there's something happens with the back-end platform, that there is a way to either extract your data, protect it, the normal things that we would expect to an enterprise to do.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's what we're trusting for Fauna to do. Well, it's understanding those basic systems management practices, as you say, like backup, recovery, how this all hangs together. Because at the end of the day, the product can be brilliant, but if it doesn't fit the existing disciplines, which are still good disciplines, you still need them, it's not particularly useful.
And how would you answer that one, Evan, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's totally true. And we have import-export tools for databases. You can, you know, take your own backups, load, reload data locally. We have a local development edition, which is a Docker image that lets you develop against the database, you know, on a laptop or in a CI/CD environment. And then we take, you know, all our data is encrypted at rest on the wire. We take you know, incremental hourly, daily, weekly backups of the entire data set. And at the same time, your data is replicated worldwide at all times. So you have some peace of mind there as well. But we know that we have a lot of work to do, too, in, you know, increasing this operational transparency, giving you more access to metrics, giving you the ability to manage your own backups within the, you know, the API and the web interface and roll forward and back. Split, copy, revert databases. And we also have a very robust access control model, which helps you know, secure access to the data itself. And, you know, there's a lot of exactly this kind of capability coming online very shortly, like the multi-region control for compliance purposes, a new Teams feature, which will let you integrate with your existing, you know, developers' access control and identity systems and that kind of thing.
Great. Well, it's been a fantastic discussion. It's been really interesting to understand. And I think from the point of view of getting people to at least think about this as a different way of doing something, I think it's been really really useful to go through. And it'd be really great to come back in the future when, you know, you've added a bit more and we can talk again about where you are, you know, 6-12 months down the line. So for now, it was fauna.com was the website. And I assume you must have a superb Twitter handle, because if you were employee number 15, you must have had an opportunity to get something really good. So where can people follow you, Evan?
I do. I'm Evan on Twitter.
Even better.
Evan on Twitter and GitHub both. So.
Do you know, I really should have done it, but I could have got CME. So I could have got my initials as my Twitter handle, but I didn't go for it. And some days I think, Oh, if only I'd done that, I should have done it, but never mind. Because I was never going to get Chris Evans, was I? Let's face it. You know, even if I got it, somebody was going to take it off me. But there you go. But Martin, any final comments?
I was going to say, I've just looked at Evan, but he doesn't have a blue tick.
No, I don't. I left before the blue ticks were a thing.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, Evan, thanks very much. It's been great to chat to you, and we look forward to catching up in the future. But for now, thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Take care.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.